having taken on this case and rendered this very helpful service to the court. Thank you. Indeed, our thanks to all counsel in the case for their fine arguments today, and the case will be taken under advisement. The next case of the morning is number 03-1362, Esther Olawu against the Attorney General. Mr. Irukara,
Your Honor.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Babatunde Irukara. I represent the petitioner, Esther Olawu. Your Honor, this case is caught in two, probably quite unlike most of the asylum or the immigration cases that will come before the court. It's first the issue of determining the removability of a legal permanent resident. And then there's a second issue of what kind of relief this permanent resident would be eligible for if removability is determined. These two components of the case require different standards of different parties. To establish removability is a burden that is on the Department of Homeland Security, which was at that time the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And the standard is relatively high. The standard is by clear, unequivocal, and convincing evidence. Ms. Olawu is a permanent resident of the United States, arriving in the United States with her, at that time, family of husband and twin daughters who had also become permanent residents. Since then, she had another set of twins, so now she has U.S. citizen children. Gainfully employed, the record will show that she was consistent in her employment as a nursing aide. Now, the exact reason why Congress enacted legislation requiring clear, unequivocal, and convincing evidence to establish removability is because people who are living in this country legally, who have been conferred the right to live here permanently, should not unilaterally be removed unless it is very clear that they have violated the laws of the United States.
But the clarity of the evidence is a somewhat different issue from the credibility determination that the immigration judge makes. And once the immigration judge has decided what the evidence is, and part of that decision is making a credibility determination, then that body of evidence might be very clear and convincing. It seems to me that's really what happened in this instance.
You're correct, Your Honor. However, the credibility determination of the immigration judge must be looked at in the context of the burden of proof, of the amount of weight of evidence that the government needs to show that this person is removable.
There could be a piece of evidence on which you have conflicting accounts. The immigration judge decides which of those accounts is the one that should be credited. And then that goes into the equation of how much evidence piles up on one side or the other to satisfy the relevant burden of proof.
You're correct, Your Honor. But then if you look at this case, you would see that the asylum hearing phase of the hearing, the immigration judge did not make any determination of the credibility of Ms. Olawu. As a matter of fact, that was not an issue. However, he determined her removability based on her own credibility, and that inconsistent application of the credibility standards creates a problem in this case, especially when the government had a higher burden to establish that she was removable. Now, clearly, the record shows that there were inconsistencies in the testimony of the witnesses of the government. The investigators, trained agents who their specific duty is to conduct investigations, had problems with tying their testimonies together.
But one there was also, he rather pejoratively labeled Ms. Olawu's testimony inconsistent, self-serving, vague, and implausible. And she says materially different things at different periods of time. And ultimately, he simply doesn't buy her argument that she was an innocent bystander, as it were, who didn't know what was in the envelope, who didn't know who this child was, who didn't know what kind of process she was engaged in, just doesn't buy it.
And, Your Honor, the record does not support the exact classification or what, you know, how he has characterized the evidence. There's nothing in the record to show that Ms. Olowo engaged in knowingly smuggling an alien into the United States. She said she carried an envelope to two big people in the Bahamas. Based on instruction, the immigration judge had the opportunity to question the purchaser of the ticket, who said, clearly, I did not send any birth certificates through her. I did not send any material through her to assist with smuggling anybody into the United States. His only understanding was that he had repeatedly given money to his ex-wife, who had said, well, now I am in the Bahamas. If you do not send me certain tickets, you will never see your daughter. Actually, she asked for money, and he said no. He said, well, purchase some tickets. And he said, well, I will send tickets to you, and this envelope, this ticket will be given to you on the condition that you surrender my daughter to whoever brought the envelope.
I realize that's her account, but there is other evidence that suggests, you know, one minute she's the mother of the child, the next minute she's the godmother, the next minute, you know, she has a passport, and, you know, all of a sudden she produces these Nigerian passports for the other ladies.
Your Honor, she never produced those passports. Those passports were recovered in the bathroom. She never knew anything about the passport. She never consistently claimed
anything. They were in the
bag. Your Honor, what happened was
that... Then there's another passport, the child's passport, in the bathroom in the Bahamas. There's just a lot of evidence in this record that if you disregard it, then she's fine, but the immigration judge wasn't required to disregard that.
No, Your Honor, he wasn't required to disregard that. But
then, then we are faced with the deferential standard of review. If there is evidence that he could have credited, then we have to ask what the case looks like in light of that evidence.
Well, yeah, at the end of the day, we would still come to the crucible of, based on the evidence that the government witnesses presented, was that sufficient to the standard, which is clear, unequivocal, and convincing
right,
evidence.
And if he credits their statements and finds whatever discrepancies may have been there to be minor, which he does, then she was smuggling the child in.
Your Honor, you're entirely correct. If he credits the evidence,
right,
if the discrepancies are minor, but Your Honor, the discrepancies are not minor in
I'm
this case.
I'm not an immigration judge. I don't even want to be an immigration judge. You know, we take the record that comes up to us.
And that is why his decision is what you're reviewing in this court. And that is why this fact being presented to you become relevant in the context of looking at how he arrived at that decision based on a combination of the facts. There was corroboration to her testimony. I mean, I think it would have been very important to at least establish for sure one way or the other, since it was the government's burden, that there was some independent evidence that shows that she had a clear motive and intention and knew what conduct she was engaging in. And that would have been presented in a way by showing that, well, these are these false certificates. They seem to have arrived, and you know what the process was. The only way to determine that was to produce whoever made the purchases of the tickets she traveled on and presented that to them. The immigration agent had the chance to question him. The immigration judge had the chance to question him. His testimony is uncontroverted. The judge does not believe he's not credible, and he says, I never sent any such thing. I mean, Your Honor, I understand what you're saying, but we have a wide gap between how the judge arrived at his finding based on the level and the weight of evidence that he was placing on the government witnesses and the required standard and what the testimony really is, Your Honor. I would reserve the rest of my argument for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from Ms. Gadwin.
Good morning, Your Honor. Terry Skadron representing the Attorney General John Ashcroft in this matter. The court today has only one real issue before it, and that is a relatively straightforward one, and that is whether the immigration judge correctly found that this petitioner was inadmissible because she knowingly attempted to assist Nigerian nationals enter the United States illegally. All other issues in the case have essentially dropped out. The asylum claim, I'll just note at the outset, is controlled by the court's recent decision in Afforji. Now, the petitioner has...
Would you expand on that, please? How is it controlled by that decision?
In Afurji, the court considered a torture convention asylum claim from a Nigerian national who claimed that she qualified for protection because her U.S. citizen daughters would be subject to female genital mutilation, otherwise known as FGM, if they accompanied her to Nigeria. And the court found that the petitioner could not predicate a torture claim on derivative harm to be suffered by her citizen children who were not subject to deportation. The only distinction here is that Alowo's children are lawful permanent residents. That's not a meaningful distinction. They are not subject to the removal order. Neither is their biological father. He's a lawful permanent resident and could remain here.
Two of the children are American citizens?
She has two sets of twins, two boys who are U.S. citizens, two daughters who are permanent residents, who were 10 years old as at the hearing. As a conceptual matter, the 4D decision controls here. There really is no basis for distinguishing it. And in some respects, this is a weaker case than in a 4D. In a 4D, the whereabouts of the biological father were unknown. The court was confronted with a scenario that potentially the U.S. citizen children might have to remain in foster care after their parents' removal. The whereabouts of the biological father are known. He is here. He's entitled to remain. In addition...
Why do you call him a biological father? Is there some other kind of father that's involved in the case?
Well, there is no other father that we're aware of. It could be an adoptive father, but we're talking about having an adult within the United States who can care for the minor children.
So he hasn't been prosecuted for any part of this, even though there's language in the record that suggests that it was his friend who wanted the child to be brought in from the Bahamas and so on. The government has paid no attention to his potential role in this matter?
To my knowledge, the government has only pursued immigration proceedings against the mother, that there is no, that the U.S. Attorney's Office declined to prosecute the mother, and I don't know if the father's case was presented. Yeah, that's a question of prosecutorial discretion.
I know. It's just a sort of Damocles is hanging over the father, and the minute she's removed from the country, then you file a notice to appear against him. This argument is a bit hollow.
Well, I don't know that there are any plans to put him in proceedings. Certainly the case against the mother was, the stronger case in that she was the one who was apprehended at pre-inspection in the Bahamas. She's the one who physically was accompanying the women and the child to the United States. So I really can't speak to that, Your Honor.
Which apparently she's doing at his direction. I just find it all a little weird. But
well, there's also on the asylum claim, there's the additional element that on the merits of the asylum claim itself, I don't know if this evidence was introduced at all in Ofordi, but there was uncontroverted evidence from the State Department that in Nigeria, the father controls the decision whether the children undergo FGM. And she testified, the father was not called to testify, but she testified that both she and her husband opposed FGM, but that their families would want it done with the daughters and that they would not oppose it.
Anybody have alerted state authorities to that statement? Anybody in your organization alerted?
The Department of State?
No. Has anyone in your department alerted anyone in the Illinois Child Welfare Department that statement has been made?
I'm not aware of any contact between DHS and the Illinois State Department.
Don't you think that that department has some responsibility toward a situation like that? Parents are going to take a child and expose a child to that kind of danger?
I would agree with you, Your Honor. I think that they do have an interest in it.
Don't you think the United States government has some kind of responsibility to work with the states with respect to child abuse like that?
Your Honor, I I do believe the state has an interest in it. I can't speak for DHS's position on this matter.
No, you can speak for the department, though.
I can speak for the Department of Justice. We are, the issue before the court, of course, is the removal order here
and the
legitimacy
and
of that order.
The state may decide that those parents aren't fit parents.
And potentially they could. But the issue with regard to the viability of the removal order is the issue that was essentially resolved in Apogee.
You had someone else in the state of Illinois announce they were taking their children someplace so the children could be tortured. I think the state authorities would probably be very interested in knowing about that.
I agree, Your Honor, and I do believe that that is a legitimate thing for the Department of Justice to raise with the Department of Homeland Security.
With
DHS, which is now the...
might be a thing for you to raise with the state authorities.
Well, we are representing DHS, and they are the ones who would be responsible for the removal.
That's not something that worries the three of us under Article. You're all under the same article of the Constitution. You figure out what your bureaucracies ought to be doing, but somebody probably ought to be telling the state of Illinois that statement was made about those parents said they were going to take these children back and expose them to that.
Well, I will certainly take the court's concerns back to my office. I will do that. I just would like to comment briefly, if the court has no further questions on the asylum claim, just I would also note just one final point on asylum, that the immigration judge also found that he would deny asylum as a matter of discretion because of Alolo's participation in the alien smuggling scheme. That was at page 44 of the administrative record. And that's independent of any issue concerning FGM to the children. Just briefly, I want to touch on the what petitioner's counselor said with regard to this court's standard of review. And our position is that, yes, at the administrative level, the INS bore the burden of proving inadmissibility by clear and convincing evidence, but that determination rested on disputed factual issues, and under the INA Section 242B4B, those are subject to a substantial evidence standard of review, which the court, I know, is familiar with. So first, the immigration judge had to determine the historical facts, and then based on his factual findings, determine whether the INS met its burden by clear and convincing evidence. We would submit that based on the inconsistencies in Aloha's testimony internally between her testimony and that of her witnesses, and based on the testimony of the service witnesses, which was essentially consistent on all material points, that the immigration judge's factual determinations must stand, and therefore the finding of removability must stand.
Tell me, if you could help me out with something here, if you could, before you sit down. The two female children here, they're not citizens of this country, I gather.
No, they're permanent residents.
They're permanent residents, but citizens of Nigeria, is that right?
Citizens of Nigeria.
I see. And they are deportable, what, derivatively with their...
They are not subject to deportation at all.
Because of the parent. Because they have one parent who's not subject to deportation, is that right?
They were never... The children would be charged independently with deportability if...
In that, I see.
Yeah, they would be issued separate NTAs, notices to appear. They were not served with anything. They are entitled to remain here.
So they're in no jeopardy that way. Okay.
No, they are not.
If both parents were subject to deportation, then you would issue a separate charge against the children, is that right?
There is no charge against... There would have to be an independent charge against the children. There is none here. The children, if both were subject to deportation, the parents would have to make a decision as to whether they brought the children with them to Nigeria, or whether they made other alternative arrangements for the children in the
United
States.
Would the children have a right to stay if both parents were deported?
The children would, if they're not subject to deportation. Yes, they would have a legal right to remain. Certainly, they would have to be placed with a guardian if both parents were leaving.
And in their parents' deportation proceedings, would they be represented in any way, independently?
If they were not...
Assuming they were not subject themselves to deportation, yes.
It's likely that the issue of where the children would reside would come up. I don't think that they would be precluded from having representation at the hearing, but that would be an issue that would be outside of the confines of the issues that the immigration...
I actually don't know.
I think
what's going to happen to the children? The children may follow the mother, or they may not follow the mother, or they may stay. The father may follow the mother.
These are issues that very well could come up with any kind of deportation, and they are tough issues when one parent and not another is being deported. But there's nothing intrinsic about a Nigerian FGM case that would raise these issues.
But what there is intrinsic that I think Judge Ripple's getting at is that there's a conflict of interest, in a sense. There's a separate set of interests that the children have in a context like this, where the mother, or perhaps the mother and the father in a different case, were subject to removal because of alien smuggling, for example, but the children hadn't done that, so they weren't. Now, obviously, in different cases where the removability is based on coming in on a tourist visa and everybody just stays too long in the tourist visa, presumably everyone in the family is in the same situation. But there are plenty of cases like this one, and if there's no systematic way of making sure that the children's interests are protected, that might be a pretty serious flaw in the system.
I would submit, Your Honor, it is a state interest, and I would agree with, I
but
think...
the state doesn't know. The DHS, the Department of Children and DCFS in Illinois, has no idea that these immigration proceedings are going on. They have nothing to do as it is.
That's right. They are not... there's nothing in the immigration statute that requires immigration authorities, I believe, to notify the state authorities. I believe that is, the state authorities are the ones who would have the primary interest, and I do agree with the court that this is something that the state authorities have a strong interest in being informed about. But it, again, of course, it doesn't bear on the validity of this particular removal order. But I will take the court's concerns back to my office. I'm not aware of anything in the regulations that directly address the court's concerns. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the questions that you've raised actually address the two most important issues in this case. First, the role of anybody in this alien smuggling case and whether it went to other departments or whether there was additional prosecution. In fact, yes, there was significant investigation. The home of the Ms. Oloa was surveilled for a significant period of time. There were issues as to whether to release this child into her custody. There were conversations with Ms. Oloa's husband. Clearly, what this leads to is this was more like a classic hit and run situation. It shows that the government did not have a clear case that this woman knowingly, because the factor here is that she should have knowingly known that she was engaging in alien smuggling. And I'm going to distinguish this case from the Ofori case because her two children are permanent residents. The rights of the children in the Ofori case to either live in the United States or even to return to the United States if their parent or parents chose to take them away remains inviolate. That is not the case with permanent resident children. And there are a myriad of situations that can make any permanent resident, for that matter, removable from the United States or inadmissible after leaving the United States. And those are factors that were not considered by the immigration judge. Now, the discretionary factor in his decision is based on her participation in an alien smuggling situation, which in itself, we're arguing, was a flawed method of arriving at her removability. And that would be my submission, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for their helpful presentation.